This is Live at Politics and Prose, a program from Slate and Politics and Prose Bookstore in Washington, D.C., featuring some of today's best writers and top thinkers.
It's a pleasure tonight this afternoon to introduce Amy Wilkinson. She'll be talking about her book, The Creator's Code, The Six Essential Skills of Extraordinary Entrepreneurs. I know there are a few entrepreneurs in the audience. I happen to know them, so I know they're entrepreneurs. So that's great. Amy's a corporate leader, university lecturer, and entrepreneur herself, and of course now she is a first-time author. She's worked in executive roles at McKinsey & Company and J.P. Morgan. She founded her own export company called Alegre that provided a platform for artisans in indigenous communities to sell their goods in the United States on the U.S. market, and she has served in government working on trade policy. So I think based on all of that and a lot more that I'm not telling you, it's safe to conclude that she's thought about business in many varied and broad contexts. As I mentioned, this is her first book. In it, she describes the common denominators, the code, that distinguishes successful entrepreneurs and innovators from those whose ideas never take off, those who don't know how to translate an idea into an enterprise that's either solving a problem that exists someplace in the world or that is meeting consumer demand for an innovative product. To crack the code, she spent 5 years interviewing leaders of more than 200 companies that generate over $100 million in revenue or serve more than 100,000 people. I think you've heard of many of the ones that she cites in the book. Under Armour, of course, is our great local example that we always love to, cite in here in Washington. Your University of Maryland football player sweat, you know, through his thing, needed a better garment, et cetera. So now we all wear Under Armour. Chipotle, Airbnb, you know, and JetBlue, and the list, Spanx, the list goes on and on. The Creator's Code provides a roadmap that outlines six key elements common to successful innovators and creators. I'm sure she'll explain more about what those are. I think one clear takeaway from the book is that successful creators and innovators are willing to come up with ideas that involve risk and that disrupt traditional norms. I mean, if you think about Uber, I guess that's one, you know, the most talked about examples nowadays here in Washington anyway. And I think what's also so interesting about all of this is that perhaps not surprisingly, many of the greatest innovations turn out to be born when a serendipitous moment sort of collides with an open mind. And if that mind were not open, the serendipitous moment probably would be lost. And that seemed to me a kind of common denominator also of many of these innovators. Anyway, I'm going to let Amy tell you more about what she found out during her research. Please join me in giving her a warm welcome to Politics and Prose.
So I have to say that being in Politics and Prose is particularly exciting to me because this book was written in Washington, D.C., basically in DuPont Circle. And this is an example of creators. This is an independent bookstore. It was started by two women, one who answered another's classified ad in the local newspaper. And then they created something that's very meaningful in Washington. And Lissa and Brad acquired it and are scaling it. And they are also creators and very creative people. And I'm very proud to say that Brad has an MBA from Stanford. I'm going back to teach a class at Stanford Business School on this book and the material in just 2 months. So you can be a creative and a book lover and reader and also a business person. So I'm absolutely thrilled to be at Politics and Prose. And I guess I will start with the story of Kevin Plank. Well, maybe I should wind back a tiny bit and say I moved to D.C. from San Francisco to do a White House fellowship. And that's how I got into Washington. It's now 10 years ago. And I was doing trade and economics work. And during that period of time, I actually stayed 4 years and did economics in the White House. And during that time, I was invited to this party in New York. It was kind of an awe-inspiring moment for me. It was in the basement of this super hip place, and I looked around, and there were the founders of Google and eBay and the Gilt Group and all of these kind of amazing startups, and they were creating and scaling new ideas. No red tape, no bureaucracy, nothing that was slowing them down. And what I started wondering was, what's the secret sauce? Like, what do these people know? What are the common characteristics that all of us could learn, and then how would you take that into the world really with like a public policy mindset, because I'm trained as a sociologist, and so I'm fascinated with people, what makes them tick, especially business people. So I have an MBA, and I'm interested in revenue and results and productivity and job creation. And so it just seemed to me that that kind of night in this dark basement bar in New York, that if I could actually study these people, if I could go out and ask them a lot of questions and then figure out across geographies and across different kinds of pursuits what made it work, that more of us could go and do this. And so that's the idea behind the Creators Code, is that everyone can create and scale ideas. Like, every single person has the ability to do that. And the code is 5 years of research informing 6 skills. So hopefully I did the homework and we can hand it off and people can actually be very advantaged in creating and scaling their ideas. So that's how the book comes into being in the very beginning. The story of Kevin Plank. So I do love this story. It opens the book. He is local, Baltimore. He went to Georgetown Prep, was kicked out of Georgetown Prep. So he's the youngest of 5 brothers, the only one not to graduate from Georgetown Prep. He bounced into a military academy, really, really wanted to play Division I football, and was 5'11 and 230 pounds, not a great athlete. Slow, just not somebody who was recruited by any single team. And the Terps coach at the time describes Kevin Plank as somebody who, quote, willed his way onto the field. And then he was known as Maryland's sweatiest player. He just sweated more than everybody else. He just worked harder, never missed a day of practice. And at one point, he weighed the cotton shirt under his Terps uniform. And when it was soaking wet, it weighed 3 pounds. And he just couldn't afford the weight. So he, like a lot of creators, just decided to solve his own problem. And he went into College Park, Maryland, to a local fabric store and sort of described the comical and kind of embarrassing problem that he had as a football player. And he found out that synthetic fabric would wick away moisture. And so he bought this stretchy bolt of fabric and took it to a local tailor with $450. And they came up with 7 different prototype T-shirts. And he had all the Terps locker room try on these shirts. And today, Under Armour is a $3 billion in revenue brand. It's enormous. The little-known secret that Kevin likes to say is it's the same fabric as found in women's lingerie. So really big, tough football players are all going around in these silky, smooth fabrics under their uniforms. And the growth segment out of Under Armour right now is women. So women athletes are fueling the growth right now of Under Armour. He's also made some big acquisitions you guys have probably seen in the news, Map My Fitness and My Fitness Pal. So they're going towards digital and having your clothes instead of the Apple Watch, which we're waiting on Monday, Tuesday, for this big announcement of the Apple Watch. So Kevin Plank is making a bet that the next wave of that is actually going to be data in your clothing. So he's always looking forward as one of these creative creator entrepreneur type people, and he's right here. So what do these people have in common? The research basically shows 6 skills. The first, we'll run through them real quick, and then we'll just throw it open for questions, and you guys can tell me what's most interesting. The first is called Find the Gap. So Kevin is an example. I mean, all of these creators do all 6 things. So that's the other takeaway here, is that we might be naturally good at a couple of them, 2 or 3, but the idea is that all of us can learn to do all 6 skills. And when you bring them together, that's like the code. It unlocks the magic. So the first is find the gap. So how do you find a gap? One way you do it is asking questions. So who knows how many questions a 5-year-old would ask a day? Anybody? Guesses? Yeah. Anyone else? No? 100. 100 questions is basically, research shows. So 5-year-olds will ask about 100 questions a day. As we get older, we stop asking questions. So by the time you're 40, you might be asking 3, 4, 5 questions a day. So that's the big difference. It's like, you know, creators continue to ask questions. So they're not afraid to say, oh, hey, you know, I have a kind of sweaty problem. How do I solve it? Where do I go? Who do I ask? How do I keep probing this kind of question, and it will lead to an answer. So that's a big thing about finding a gap. there are different ways to do it. One is to build something unique. So again, Kevin Plank and Under Armour. Another example would be Elon Musk. So the Tesla and SpaceX founder, he basically likes to solve problems. He talks all about solving unaddressed problems. And one of them with SpaceX is to build a rocket that would be cheaper and ideally reusable. So there have been headlines in the last couple of weeks, too. He's trying to land a rocket on a platform in the ocean. I just saw Elon 2 weeks ago in L.A., and he's saying, you know, they're going to try that again in April. He expects by June it will work. And the problem that he's trying to address with SpaceX is, you know, how do you make this cheaper so we will do more space exploration? He has brought all in-house manufacturing at SpaceX, and they are building rockets now that resupply the International Space Station at one-tenth the price that NASA did. I mean, it's extraordinary ability of a private company to take over government contracts. He's solving a problem. That's one thing. Another way to find a gap is to see something that works somewhere else and then transport it across a divide. So this example that we all know would be Starbucks, right? Howard Schultz saw this coffee culture that he loved in Italy, and he brought it back to Seattle. And I grew up just south of Seattle. When he did that, when Starbucks started, he didn't get it quite right, which a lot of people don't know. They started Starbucks with the idea of bow tie clad waiters and opera music and a stand up coffee bar with little porcelain cups like you would see in Italy. And it was the grunge scene in Seattle. So people were showing up in Gore-Tex jackets. It rains all the time. They wanted to, you know, hang out and talk. So part of this is seeing a gap in a different way and then taking something that already works and reapplying it. It's another thing that all of us can look at doing is what works in one place and how would we transport it with a twist somewhere else. And then the third way of thinking about a gap or finding a gap would be to see a couple things and bring them together. This would be integrating things. And Chipotle founder Steve Ells is a great example. He's a classically trained chef. He went to the New York Culinary Academy. He, of all the people that I spent time with, I mean, he really is a foodie. He talks about the ingredients, the cooking temperatures, the times, like, you know, the smells, everything about cooking. But when he started this company, he just was hanging out in the Mission District of San Francisco and loved burritos. He's a classically trained chef that loves burritos. And he started saying, hey, how come fast food is only hamburgers that are frozen that we reheat at the time? Can't you have something faster but cooked in front of you? And so he combined basically fast food and cooking to be fast casual. It created a new sector. And you see creators doing this kind of thing. So luxury vehicles and all-terrain vehicles becomes the luxury SUV, huge category of automobiles. Or shabby chic, put that together in the design world, it creates a whole lot of interior design concept. So finding a gap, there are different ways to approach it, but we can all do these things. We can all be looking out and asking questions and doing them. So that's skill one. Skill two is what I'm calling drive for daylight. So this is how do you manage speed like a race car driver. And the way you do it is always look for the light, like you always look forward onto a horizon. And people who are driving race cars, I actually signed up for NASCAR driving school and drove Road Atlanta to see if this analogy worked. You don't look at the lines on the pavement and you don't look at the competitors next to you because you are moving too fast. So you only look forward. And there's also this no time for the rearview mirror thing, like, you know, entrepreneurs or creators are not looking back. They are only looking forward. An example is Elizabeth Holmes. And have people heard about Elizabeth Holmes here? I believe that she's the next Steve Jobs in terms of innovating within the healthcare field. And she has spent 10 years building a company that now operates from the former Facebook headquarters in Palo Alto. It is a blood diagnostics, a lab testing company. And so with a couple drops of blood in a finger stick technology, she can turn around 200 to 300 lab tests in just a couple hours. It's an extraordinary way that she believes we will prevent disease. So she's just been the cover of Fortune magazine recently. She signed a big deal with Walgreens. But the idea is that she has for 10 years been looking forward on a pursuit that is the idea that if we could test easily, painlessly, and have multiple little tests of blood diagnostics, we would prevent cancer. Instead of catching cancer when it's a tumor, you might detect it in your blood and be able to prevent. Or instead of detecting heart disease when you have a heart attack, you might be able to see in your blood analytics that this was coming and change your lifestyle or be on a medication that would stop that. So it's a very long horizon pursuit that is also, as an entrepreneur, taken quite a long time to build and stand up. But be on the lookout for Elizabeth Holmes, because she's now just gaining more public traction. So that's the example of driving for daylight. The third skill is what I'm calling fly the OODA loop. And I know there are a couple friends that are in the military here. It comes originally out of the Air Force. So it's an Air Force fighter pilot mantra, and it stands for observe, orient, decide, and act. And there was a man named John Boyd, known as 42nd Boyd, and he could shoot down an opposing fighter jet in 40 seconds or less. And the legend has it that he absolutely never lost. So the question is, well, how can you be that superior? And the answer is you could observe, orient, decide, and act faster than a competitor and change the dynamics of a fight. And so if the competitor's responding to something that already is overtaken, you are staying a step ahead. So in the business world, in the entrepreneurship world, this is even more relevant, I believe, than in combat situations, because people are outmaneuvering competitors by observing something, orienting, deciding, and acting. And a great example is the PayPal team. So PayPal started, and it had six different business models. It started as an encrypted security technology, then it was a virtual wallet, then it was beaming money between Palm Pilots. Did anyone here have a Palm Pilot? Okay, so there's a few Palm people. That's gone away, but PayPal is still very alive. So they kept maneuvering, and they would observe. So with the Palm, for example, they built this beautiful technology to get money to beam between devices, and then they realized that a lot of people online were trying to use the demo site, like the support site, that they stood up to support that technology just to transact money right there. And that seemed really strange to them, but then they oriented, decided, and acted real quick to address that. Then they also noticed that eBay at the time, a lot of people buying and selling were still sending cash in the mail. This was 1999. And people at eBay were trying to use PayPal. They were, again, trying to use this demo site. And these guys at one point said, oh, that's crazy. Like, eBay people, go away. And then they had the epiphany, and they like observed it, oriented, decided, and acted really fast to capture that. And they started embedding the PayPal logo on top of the eBay auction sites. And they basically stayed ahead of eBay. eBay was a huge company at the time, made an acquisition of BillPoint to try to stop that from happening. And these guys were so scrappy and moved so fast that they maneuvered inside the loop of a big company, and they eventually sold to eBay. They sold when I was in business school at Stanford. So in 2002, when the tech bubble burst, and I have a couple of my business school classmates here, it was doom and gloom in Silicon Valley. Like, a lot of people were saying that the tech era was over. People were closing their doors. It was just done. And the PayPal team sold successfully for $1.5 billion. And then they went on. The more interesting part of this is they go on to apply this same ability to just move faster. And they start Yelp and YouTube and LinkedIn. Elon is in this. So it's Tesla Motors and SpaceX, Dig, Palantir Technologies. They put the first money behind Facebook. It's an extraordinary story. So when you spend time with them, the first 12 guys at PayPal, and you say, what is it? Like, how did you go seed the whole second wave? They'll say, well, we learned it was going to be hard. And then we could orient to it, decide and act. We could keep moving through. So Yelp, for example, Jeremy Stoppelman, the founder CEO, he'll say, you look for a counterintuitive blip of data. That's a direct quote. Like, look for anything that seems counterintuitive and then move straight towards it. So Yelp was supposed to be an email referral system. And like embedded in one tiny little feature of their original concept was, would you like to write a review? And they didn't think anybody would want to review the local dry cleaner. They thought that wasn't going to be fun. And then they found out, like, people loved it. People loved writing the reviews. So Yelp became a review site. YouTube was supposed to be an online video dating site. So it was stood up for video dating. And then they found out, because the founders were at the local zoo and, like, just shooting video of themselves with this elephant, they were kind of clowning around. And all these people thought the elephant photos for video were, like, really interesting. And so they immediately pivoted that model and moved it to be YouTube that we know. So it's an example over and over that these guys learned it, and then they went and did it again and again. The fourth skill is called fail wisely. And the idea here is, it's not just about failing forward and failing fast. That's kind of Web 2.0 stuff that people have talked about. Creators really set a failure ratio. Like, they know they will get it wrong. If you're trying to build things that we haven't seen before, you're going to miss the mark, right? It's not going to be an automatic thing you know how to do. So if you set a ratio and say, I'm okay with being wrong 20% of the time, or 30% of the time, or 10, that makes it a whole lot easier to continue to move through again if you have setbacks. And an example, another local example, is O-Power. So do folks here know O-Power out of Alexandria? So these are two founders, Dan and Alex, and they built a company that conserves energy, but it's based on experiments. So the very first experiment was in San Marcos, California, and it was basically this. It was door knockers on homes, you know, those things that you hang on the doorknob. And they basically said, how's this going to work? They hung door knockers that said, please turn off your air conditioning, turn on your fan, be a good citizen, like, conserve energy. No one did anything. Nobody cared. It didn't change anything. So then they did door knockers that said, please turn off your air conditioning, turn on your fan. This is in the summer, like at peak times. You could save the planet. Like, global warming is real. Please do this. Nobody cared. No change of behavior. So they do a third door knocker that says, turn off your air conditioning, turn on your fan. You can save $55 on your bill a month. You would think people would save $55. Nobody changes behavior. And so they do a fourth door knocker that basically says, turn off your air conditioning, turn on your fan. 77% of your neighbors are doing this. That works. And everybody starts conserving energy. And so that company is built on that concept, is this all these experiments that people are doing over and over. They just did one this last summer in Baltimore, peak demand hours, turn off your dishwasher in the middle of the day, et cetera. Now, some of their stuff doesn't work. So they tried to do a Facebook app, thinking, oh, friends, and, you know, you could influence, turn down your usage because your Facebook friends will know. That did not work. It needs to be neighbors that you will actually physically see, evidently. So that company is an example where they're failing wisely. Like, sometimes it's working, sometimes it's not working. But they have conserved enough energy to power the city of Miami for a year, which is pretty extraordinary. In the aggregate, it's working in a big way. So the fifth skill is called network minds. And this is the idea that you bring brain power, bring minds towards you to solve problems in new ways. And we talk a lot about diversity, about what it looks like on the outside. So we talk about race and gender and socioeconomic differences. And my research basically says that doesn't matter very much. What matters is what goes on inside your head. So what brain power can you draw towards you to solve something in a new way? And a great example is inside of GE. This man named Doug Dietz is the designer of the MRI machine. And have people here had MRIs? Okay, what's it like?
Loud.
What else? Scary, claustrophobic. Anything else? Long. Okay, so Doug Dietz is a fabulous medical technology builder, and was so proud of this machine and went to a hospital to see it in use when a 7-year-old little girl was getting a scan. And so she came down the hallway with her parents, holding the hands of her parents. And the minute she saw the MRI machine, she melted down. I mean, she started crying. And then they tried to put her in it. It's loud. It's claustrophobic. It's scary. And 80% of children have to be sedated to take an MRI scan, because it's very hard to get them to understand what's going on and to stay very still. And so Doug Dietz, the man who designed it, thought that this was a terrible failure. But what he did was he networked minds, right? So he got together a very non-traditional group of people to solve the problem. A whole lot of kids, a lot of daycare providers, the Children's Art Museum, people who build exhibits for children's art museums, certainly a lot of the GE tech people, a lot of the hospital nurses and technicians and all of that. They put all of these people together and started talking about what the experience was like, especially for kids. And kids started saying, oh, you know, the kids were talking about dressing up as their older sister, what their life was like, or like dreaming about Space Odyssey or jungle camps or whatever. And designers of children's museums were talking about engaging kids in different ways. And what they came up with is the adventure series for kids. And so now MRI machines, there are 8 different adventures that kids can go on. These machines are all dressed up. Like, they look like a Space Odyssey experience. They look like a nautical experience, like you're getting into some kind of boat. They have music playing. They have decals. When kids go to the hospital, they talk to a camp counselor. They get a backpack. They have this whole story about staying quiet inside of the MRI machine. And basically, they've solved the problem. The sedation rate is down to nearly zero. It's the exact same scan, but for kids that are having this experience, they solved it, and they solved it with this networking of minds to exact same technology, totally different outcome. So the last skill is what I'm calling gift small goods. And a small good is a small favor or a small kindness. And creators of companies don't do these things alone, right? It takes a lot of other people collaborating and helping. And so in a transparent world, which we now live in, people know if you are being kind. They know if you are doing favors for people. In the workplace, it would look like forwarding a resume or critiquing a proposal or writing a few lines of code, opening a door for someone, helping someone else's career along. And this is the basis of LinkedIn. So the founder of LinkedIn, Reid Hoffman, talks quite a lot about if you make the world transparent, in the past, you could just, an employer, a boss, might be able to reference check a new employee, but the new employee could never get information about the boss, right? But now we can all get information about each other very, very quickly with a whole lot of transparency. So the idea behind gifting small goods is it used to be right, morally right, or it used to be good to be a nice guy. But we all wondered, like, do nice guys finish last? I mean, like, this whole argument. And now, actually, the counterintuitive finding is that with technology and with transparency, nice guys finish first. Because if you are one of these people who is very generously supporting other people in small ways, that is known, and others want to work with you. So they bring you information. Talent comes to you. You get more deal flow. A lot of things start happening. You become a go-to person because your reputation is amplified and known. So Reid Hoffman will also say no one's going to throw themselves in front of a train for you. It's not like they're going to spend a huge amount of effort. But all these little tiny favors or little tiny kindnesses actually add up to a very big and important reputational benefit for people who are gifting small goods. So those are the 6 skills. I want to be brief so we can take questions. The big aha here, though, is all of these people do all of these 6 things. Right, and they are learnable, teachable, very accessible. Anyone can create and scale ideas, and if you do these 6 things, it basically sets you ahead. Right now, entrepreneurs, many of us as entrepreneurs, we're trying to recreate the wheel. We're trying to go around and figure it out, and it's a kind of, you know, isolating and solo pursuit. And so by doing all of this research across and then handing over, here's the common threads, this should be able to shortcut it and at least hopefully advantage all of us in trying to create and scale ideas. So I would love questions.
about Politics and Prose. I'm just waiting it to, for it now to become a $100 million.
Hi, Amy.
Hi, Eric. The fun thing about being in the town that I live in is that my friends come to these things.
Thank you very much, and congratulations. This is an awesome achievement, and I'm so proud to see you up here. My question is about applying this code to government work. And I'd ask you, especially in this town, to reflect on that. Do you think that this code works in government? Is there a part of the code that breaks down here? I know there are entrepreneurs in government, and I know you've seen some of them, but as I was reading through the first part of the book, I'm not quite done yet. I haven't seen you talk a lot about entrepreneurs in government, and just would ask for your thoughts. Thanks.
So I do believe that these skills work everywhere. So I think they work in government. I know that you work in the Pentagon. It's a very large organization. So the research set is business founders, right? And then there are some social entrepreneurs in the data set as well. I truly do think that all of us can be using these six skills to be more effective. I think it gets harder. Sometimes you run into friction points in large organizations. Still, the idea of finding a gap, driving for daylight, flying the OODA loop, failing wisely when you hit those snags or setbacks, networking minds to bring people towards you, and then being generous in the workplace, I think that all of those six things work in government. I think that they work in large corporations as well. So the GE example is inside of a very large organization or in a large hospital setting. So I think that they're universal concepts. I think that it's harder sometimes when you're trying to stand up an initiative inside. Well, it's both good and bad. It can be harder because you can run into friction of other people saying you can't do this, or it's against, you know, the internal policy set. The great part about being a creator inside the government or inside of a large institution is you can move volume. Like, that's the beauty of government, is if you can get 1% change, it becomes an enormous change. So it might be a little harder to move, but if you can move, you know, the Titanic, you're really actually moving a very large volume change.
So you talked about solving problems collectively, and for those of us who are entrepreneurs and we're working in isolation, what are some avenues you suggest to reach out? Oftentimes I'm trying to hire someone for my entrepreneurial operation. I go to Craigslist, and I find that inconsistent or not particularly effective. Maybe you could suggest how we can get out of the isolation loop.
Sure. So that chapter, Networking Minds, is a great question because that actually outlines a few different ways to do it. One is what I'm calling flash teams. So you can assemble a flash team, a short time frame team, to solve a specific problem that it gets together and then disbands. So there are various websites that allow you to do that. One of them that I think is pretty interesting is called Hourly Nerd. It's a startup out of Harvard Business School, about 2 years old now, where you can hire Harvard MBAs by the hour to be consultants. It's great. Mark Cuban backed it, and so it's probably a fast growth company. There's another out of New York called Quad Jobs. You can hire any kind of high school or college student to do anything. There's certainly TaskRabbit, which is, you know, any task that you need to do. But there are various things that I think if you bring people together for a specific flash team. And there's plenty of data and research around this showing you don't have to be. This is Hollywood, actually. This is like the Hollywood model. Come together, make a film, disband. It's also the construction world model. Come together, build a house, often disband. Or you see it in airlines, pilots and crews. They come together for a flight, they disband. So if, you know, this is, I believe, the future of the workforce. We'll see more and more flash teams. So there are ways to do that. There are prize competitions, and I think that's a pretty interesting, you know, there have always been prize competitions. So the Wright brothers won a prize when they figured out how to fly. But the internet allows all of us to use prize competitions in different ways. So you might be able to put out on the internet, hey, I'm willing to pay $2,000 or $5,000 or whatever it is, and try to attract people to solve your problem and then win a prize. And so Innocentive is a great model of this out of Waltham, Mass, and it's solving scientific problems. But I think prize competitions is another way to attract minds.
What is that called?
Innocentive. 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 It's a fascinating company that came out. It sprung out of Eli Lilly because a lab scientist thought that too many of the pharmaceutical companies were just individually trying to solve problems. So it's an open platform for anybody who wants to try to seekers and solvers come together and solve problems. And there's a great quote in the book that the founder, Alf Bingham, says, you know, it may be some kid in Romania who has the answer for you, and you would never find them except for the internet. You put out, like, here's my problem, and I'll award a prize if you can solve it, and you attract brain power like it's never been possible before.
So also, for some of us, we have right brain or left brain. We don't have both. So do you find that oftentimes partnerships are essential to the flourishing of an entrepreneurial operation?
Yes. So that's part of the networking minds thing, too, is it's not just – this is the cognitive diversity point. So people's minds are different. You might be an introvert or an extrovert, a convergent thinker, a divergent thinker. You certainly might be trained as an anthropologist or a neuroscientist or an engineer. And the research is showing when you get all of these different kinds of brain power together, that's when you unlock – problems that we haven't solved in the past. So the Stanford D School is a great example of this. And Stanford, I'm going back to Stanford. I was educated at Stanford. They're staking a large portion of the endowment now on the D School, which is this collaboration hub to bring kids from seven different disciplines together to solve problems. So it is the place on Stanford campus where you see people from the medical school and the education school and the business school and, you know, different backgrounds all together to try to do exactly what you're talking about.
Thank you very much. That was really helpful.
Thanks. Okay, other questions? Come on, you guys. You can't just ask two questions or three questions. Okay.
I have a question. I see a bit of an overlap between the characteristics that you're describing and kind of the skills of leadership in general. Have you looked at that literature and compared it, how closely it resembles it or how different it is from it? Can you maybe make a comment on?
Sure. So, I reviewed 4,000 pages of academic studies behind this book across disciplines. So there are a number of studies, and they're coming in. Leadership tends to be organizational behavior-based academic pursuit. I'm going to go back and teach in the School of Business Management in organizational behavior. So leadership is a field, and entrepreneurship is a field. They're kind of big and squishy. Right? If you look at the academics behind them, it's organizational behavior or cognitive psychology or behavioral economics or creativity research. So yes, I've reviewed the different academic disciplines and research. I think there's quite a lot of crossover. And the class I'm teaching is an entrepreneurial leadership class, just to keep it squishy. Yeah. I don't know if that answers your question.
Yes, it sure does.
Thank you. Thanks.
In your research, was there, like, what percentage of business founders and social entrepreneurs were women versus men? And did you see any trends across, like, which one of the six maybe women had more of versus men naturally had more of, knowing that they all do, all six of them? Did you notice any trends there?
Yes. Yeah, so, because I'm a girl, I get asked this question a lot about women entrepreneurs, right, or in the data set. And over $100 million in revenue, which is my data set for entrepreneurs, women are not showing up in very large numbers. And so I think it's 12 to 14% of my data set is women. Now, they disproportionately show up in the book because I am featuring them, right? There is no reason that women are different from men in starting companies. And I kind of want to put an end to this gender difference conversation. I am a lot more interested in just who can create and scale ideas. in the past, the data and the research shows women have not had access to capital. Mm-hmm. There's the big difference. You know, Fortune 500 CEOs, they're approximately 5% women. We're just not doing well enough there. In the venture capital industry, that's about the same. It's 5 or 6% of the, you know, venture capitalists are women. So what it means is, in the past, if you were a woman, you might not be able to go get funding for your idea. You might not know who to go to. You might not have the network or the access. My research basically says women are the exact same. So in skills. They show up more in my data set and really in the world as social entrepreneurs. So if you look at that sector, women are driving the social entrepreneurship trends. Founders of Teach for America, Acumen Fund, Endeavor, you know, they are really freelancers union. I mean, they are in that space and they're driving that space. We're not seeing them as much yet driving the entrepreneurship, business entrepreneurship space. So I don't want people to think that women are different. I don't believe they are.
And as a female social entrepreneur myself, knowing that only 2% of VC dollars go to back women and women's initiatives or women's backed businesses, does your book make that correlation, or do you personally do any work on bridging that divide in your day to day work, or your work is more about educating people about the divide? I'm just curious.
I want to put forward the idea that women and men are equal.
Yeah.
And I want to be highlighting all the stories of women who've scaled over $100 million in revenue. So Spanx is in the book. Theranos is in the book. Revolution Foods, there are two moms in the East Bay of California who have $100 million in revenue. They're improving the nutrition in school lunches. That's a really cool model. And a lot of people haven't heard about them yet. Stella and Dot. So I am trying to put forward, and I've now been interviewed for this book with national media, and I only want to put forward the idea that women are in this marketplace and in the future will be more and more in the marketplace. I was the expert for the Wall Street Journal Women in the Economy Conference on women entrepreneurs. And so, you know, I know the data and I know that it's not great yet. There's a big study out of Babson College that was just released, and you should check that out. And that's about, you know, how come we're not seeing access to funding in particular for women?
Okay.
That's a problem, but it will be solved. So, yeah, let's solve it.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Could you go back for a minute about on the question of working within large organizations and talk about strategies for that? It seems like there's either the do it secretly and then present it as almost done, or start from the beginning to try to get buy-in from people who normally would say no. What would be your, or something in between? Do you have recommendations?
Yeah. So it feels to me like a lot of these things come down to building consensus or being willing to tolerate conflict inside of large organizations. And, you know, my research shows that you have to be able to tolerate conflict, and that the great entrepreneurial leaders, whether they're inside big organizations or starting their own, they have teams of intellectuals and they debate and they challenge each other and they battle it out. And consensus is thought of as bad. Right. And in large organizations, a lot of people think consensus is good. You want everybody to say yes and move that thing forward when everybody's on board. I think one of the things to try to do with people in your immediate team inside of a large organization, or look for support for dissenting points of view. I think that's what really allows change to happen. And the PayPal Mafia is a great example of this. You know, they had so many people challenging inside. Jeremy Stoppelman, the Yelp founder, said that he fired off an email to the entire senior executive team when he was an intern saying, you guys are all wrong. You're on the wrong path. You don't know what you're doing. He thought that he might get fired or in trouble for it. He was actually patted on the back. Hey, good job. Good job for speaking up, but we're now going to make this decision. We're going to go a certain way. But I think that ability to fight with people, quote unquote, inside the workplace and then have a lot of respect for differences of opinion is what to try to look for in order to spring up these new ideas.
Hi, Amy. Thanks for your nod to John Boyd and the fighter pilot entrepreneurs out there. Good to see you. I run an incubator in Dallas now focused on veterans. I wonder if you saw any trends in your research of the companies on capital and between bootstrapping, friends and family, or VC. Did you see any trends that businesses found more successful or less successful in terms of capital? Because that's a trend that we're seeing that entrepreneurs struggle with time and time again.
So I didn't measure that in my data, right? But I can talk anecdotally to it. The trend that I see is that it requires less capital to start companies. Now, that's not universal. I mean, if you're going to do an energy company or an oil and gas company or something, that's big capital. But for the most part, if you're going to do it something technology related, it's getting cheaper and cheaper to be an entrepreneur. My data set basically shows the struggle to try to get access to capital. And it's not just women. I mean, we were saying before women struggled to get access to capital. There are a lot of people raising credit card rounds, a lot of people starting companies on credit cards. Kevin Plank here had $35,000 or $40,000 of credit card debt before Under Armour started. Sarah Blakely, the Spanx founder, founded that company with only $5,000. Of her own savings. That is wholly owned company by Sarah Blakely. It's amazing. $5,000 started up what is an enormous retail company now. The Airbnb founders, that's a great story because they did the credit card thing. They were turned down, I think, 45 times by venture capitalists. People, do you guys, who uses Airbnb? Okay. So it was a really weird, strange, and slightly creepy idea to have strangers sleeping in your house, right? Or sleeping on your air mattress or your extra couch or your extra bedroom. Nobody would fund that company. And so the way that they got by, which is really great, is in 2008, around the presidential conventions, they are designers by the Rhode Island School of Design, they're graduates. They designed these cereal boxes that were Obama O's, Hope in Every Bowl, and Cap'n McCain's, A Maverick in Every Bite. And they sold cereal, and they raised $25,000 off of the cereal box designs. I mean, it's crazy, and that's how that company got funded. So it's sort of, you know, every story seems different, but the struggle to get financing seems real.
Yeah, it seems like this is a golden age for entrepreneurship. Entrepreneurs are, you know, celebrities. Yet there have been some recent studies that have come out that are suggesting that there's actually less entrepreneurship now than there was in the American economy in the past. So the boring 50s or 60s were actually generating more new companies. And I think it was something, whether it's true or not, I'm curious in your comment, where actually more companies for the first time are dying than are being created. So I'm kind of curious if you've run across this in your work and if you have any take on if that's true and if, you know, why, if it is.
Yes. So my research is backed by the Kauffman Foundation, which is the large entrepreneurship foundation that's also put out that report that says that, you know, we are seeing less founders, we're seeing less entrepreneurship starting right now. Question mark, why is that? And the research is saying millennials are not starting companies like generations in the past have. And then the question is, why is that? And people are guesstimating that out of the 2008 recession that people are less willing to take on risk, that it was a very scary time to come out of college and then see this big recessionary economy. And so there's just less appetite for millennials to be pioneering their own companies. I also think that the student debt, the student loan burden on this generation is preventing people from starting companies. And that's something real we need to think about and try to help with and address. And so the data is showing that millennials are not as likely to start companies as previous generations. But the good news is the data also shows that the average age of a first-time founder in the U.S. is 39 years old. And so that's what people don't realize is it's not like Mark Zuckerberg and everyone has to wear a hoodie and be in Silicon Valley and do a tech company or do a mobile app. Like, you know, a 39-year-old, if that's the average, that means that plenty of people older and younger are starting companies. And the fastest growing demographic, which the data shows too, is baby boomers. So people are living longer. They are healthier. They don't all just want to go golfing when they retire. Some of them really want to start up companies. And so that's a real growth segment is baby boomers who will be first time or second time or whatever entrepreneurs. So I think this is a reason why this book matters even more now. Like, so if we are seeing less entrepreneurs that are striking out right now, and that's the data as of about 6 weeks ago that just was published, I think the Creator's Code and people to encourage them to create and scale is even more important. So I'm a nerd, so I know all the data. I mean, I like the data. The job creation in the United States is companies less than 5 years old. So, I mean, if we want to create net new jobs, we need people to start companies. Because that's basically what the data shows. So you need, you know, more people starting and then more people ramping. They can't just be two or three person startups. We need, you know, new companies and we need high growth companies to create jobs.
I think we have time for only one more question. I know it's been so interesting. We probably could go on all night, but I think the last word is on you. And
okay.
Just one more thing. If you don't have a copy of the book yet, we have plenty up front. Please grab one and Amy will be happy to sign them when the event is over. And one more question.
Okay.
I have about three questions, so I'll try to make these three questions into one. But it's sort of related to your last point about job creation. A lot of the entrepreneurs that I meet, particularly tech entrepreneurs, are looking to create something that they're going to sell, and they're not really thinking about building businesses to last and the jobs that they're going to be creating. They also tend to be fairly nervous about talking to investors about a workforce strategy because there's a lot of pressure to have people work day and night for nothing until they get this. So there is a bit of a disconnect that worries me. The question I want to ask, though, is that there are a growth of accelerators, incubators. I run a foundation that does a program on entrepreneurship. What advice do you have? Because it seems like there's sort of a collision of activity out there. There's just so much going on. Some of it isn't so great. Some of it is terrific. What do you think are the characteristics of this sort of ecosystem that supports entrepreneurs that are important and that we ought to be focusing on?
So, yeah, thanks for the question. I think that there are a lot of accelerators that are standing up. I think a couple of things about that. Track record really matters. So if you're popping up and you have a brand new kind of incubator or accelerator, I, as an entrepreneur, would be a lot less likely to want to join unless you can see the track record of founders or people as real serious advisors and investors and people that will make things happen. And this point is the same for partners, creators, co-founding companies, or finding allies to work with, regardless of if it's an incubator or not. Prehistory matters. That's what Peter Thiel will say. So he's the co-founder of PayPal and Palantir, the first investor at Facebook, for example. And what Peter will say over and over is you really need to know people. You need to know them over time. You need to know how they respond under pressure, how they, what decisions they will make, all of those kinds of things in order to want to partner with them. You don't want to marry the person you stand next to at the slot machine in Las Vegas. It might be great. You might hit a jackpot, but the chances are pretty good that it's going to be bad. And that's what Peter Thiel tells people. Like, that's his quote of, you know, like, hey, you, prehistory matters. So with incubators or with partnerships or with investors, with advisors, all of that stuff, you don't want to just see somebody at a networking conference and think that you want to be, you know, starting your company with them. So that's something to think about. The other thing about accelerators and incubators is if they are tied to universities, the research center and the extra support, especially that comes off of relationships with academic research institutions, is often very, very helpful. So that's part of the magic of Silicon Valley is Stanford University has been there a long time. Berkeley has been there a long time. There are lots of people supporting startups there that are not necessarily the founders or the research triangle, you know, in the South or in and around Boston. There are so many other academics and supporters and collaborators that may not be visible, but they're actually part of making that success work. That getting close to and collaborating with universities is really key. And I just want to say a very, very big thank you to Steve Lagerfeld in the back there, has helped me write this book. And he was the longtime editor of the Wilson Quarterly. And it would not have been possible if Steve hadn't read so many drafts. So big thank you to Steve and all of my friends in the room.
Live at Politics and Prose is a co-production of The Bookstore and Slate.com. For information about upcoming Politics and Prose events, visit politics-prose.com. And please let us know what you think of this program. Our email is podcasts@slate.com.